Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN or online at abc.net.au/RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, Aboriginal leader and educator Dr. Chris Sara argues the need for a new relationship between the First Peoples of Australia and White Australia, a relationship based on respect and high expectations. He stresses the contribution of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples must be recognised and valued. In tonight's talk, entitled Beyond Victims, The Challenge of Leadership, Chris Sara outlines the type of leadership he believes is essential if the proposed recognition of Indigenous Australians in the Constitution is to have any meaningful impact. It's time for a new approach, is his basic message. Dr. Chris Sara is the founder and chairman of the Stronger, Smarter Institute. In the late 1990s, he took on the challenges of Indigenous education as principal of the troubled Cherbourg State School in southeast Queensland. Under his leadership, the school became nationally acclaimed for its pursuit of his Stronger, Smarter philosophy, which significantly improved the educational and life outcomes of its students. Chris Sara grew up in Bundaberg in Queensland and is the youngest of 10 children. His autobiography is entitled Good Morning, Mr. Sara. Let's head now to the State Library of Queensland and listen to Chris Sara deliver the annual Griffith Review lecture, Beyond Victims, The Challenge of Leadership.
As an educator, I'm reasonably content about the part that I've played in changing expectations of Aboriginal children and Torres Strait Islander children, and I'm proud to say in some ways poor white children in Australia as well. I would not pretend for a moment that we are all the way there, but we're a very long way away from where we were in education. That said, I watch with some dismay Australia repeat a pattern which for more than 200 years has probably delivered more failure and sorrow rather than success. This is not a black or white issue. This is an issue for all of us. And my sense is, my very real sense, is that if we can understand some of the fundamental aspects of a high expectations relationship, then we truly can transcend the challenges we face together. While many have warned me that there's a great deal of risk in saying what I have to say tonight, even more yearn for things to be said. I know that when one pulls back the curtain and says publicly what is often spoken of quietly behind closed doors, people get angry and defensive, particularly those who recognise their own behaviours. And while I accept that some people will get angry and sooky, I honestly hope, that even more welcome the opportunity for frank discussion and to transcend the toxicity that stifles our relationship today. To my supporters and detractors alike, I say this. Argue the merits of what I say, but don't twist my words. Don't cherry-pick details and quote them out of context or pretend that this very serious discussion can be reduced to just a few phrases. Being subject to public attacks is one of the costs of leadership. And while it's often hurtful on a personal level, this is not a reason to avoid leading when leading is required. Leadership means putting the needs of others, the greater good if you like, ahead of your own comfort. It includes an obligation to call things as you see them, to put one's beliefs out there to kick around, and in so doing, offer some solutions. It has long been said that leadership is characterised by three traits: courage, compassion, and commitment. Many leaders are courageous and work hard, but often lack commitment to lead for all. Others have compassion and commitment to a cause, but not the courage to call out bad behaviours. History's great leaders exhibit and balance all three of these traits. Tonight, I trust you with frank insights from someone who is very much an insider in some ways. Some might experience my truths as brutal. I have no wish to wield words like weapons here tonight. I have made many tough calls throughout my career to date, but I've always done my best to play the issue and not the person. And while my truths may be brutal, I have no interest in pitchfork politics. I also have no interest in playing to any particular constituency. Some of my great friends and supporters will find aspects of what I say tonight to disagree with. Disagreement is welcome and should be welcome. We can often learn as much from those with contrary opinions as those who share our view. Instead, so often, we've become a land of outrage. Beliefs which aren't our own are shouted down and denounced, often by those with bruised or an out-of-control ego. It might make some of us feel good, but it does not help us reach sane, common-sense solutions. Criticisms and constructive feedback offered with pure motives are not reasons to get angry and abuse others. Rather, they are gifts to reflect upon for the purpose of growing, evolving, and being the best that we can be. Without frank discussion, the willingness to speak what we know and believe in our hearts, nothing will change. If honesty offers a chance for all of us to transcend the current challenges we face together, then clearly being honest is worth the risk. To be silent and to lack courage here is collusion with the toxicity that contaminates our society. There is no pleasure for any of us as we reflect on the futility of the billions spent to somehow fix Aboriginal Australia. After all these decades, after billions spent to close the gap, after apologies and reconciliations, despite most Australians wanting things to change, we have got the very foundation of our relationship wrong. In order to fix Aboriginal Australia, we must be mindful of the notion of fixing white Australia. And at that foundation, this means fixing the relationship that we share. My intention from here is not to entice you into a sense of despair, but rather a sense of hope, a very real and authentic sense of hope. I've seen high expectations relationships exist in Australia, and they are something brilliant to behold. In a dramatically remote part of Australia, South Australia on the APY lands, Huey, an old Aboriginal man, sits at the foot of ancient hills on his country under a crisp yet brilliant blue winter sky. His face is unshaven, his hair all dusty and his clothes somewhat dishevelled, but what is crystal clear and diamond bright in his eyes is a profound sense of love in his heart and hope for the children around him. Around him, the dust is shifting thanks to the active and ever-shifting bare feet of more than 100 Aboriginal children from the local school. The local school in Dulcana. The principal, Paula Maguire, has insisted that as part of their school program, they must spend time on country learning with local elders. She stands and she scans the area with a confidence anchored in part by knowing that back in their school, the children's classrooms are as intellectually rigorous, but in a different way, with walls adorned with rich standard Australian English text in print alongside high-quality examples of student work. The classrooms at Indulcana School are as intellectually stimulating as any other that one might see in a metropolitan or provincial part of Australia. In many remote schools, this is not always the case. At Indulcana, it's clear there is no need to choose between strong in culture or smart in modern ways of Australia. Paula Maguire knows children can have both. And as principal, she works tirelessly with her team and the community to ensure they are afforded this human right to be strong and to be smart. Back on country, it's hard to know exactly what is exciting the children most at any particular point of the afternoon, as they speak rapidly in their own traditional Aboriginal language. Speckled amongst them are all of the school's white teachers, Aboriginal teachers and teacher aides, and a handful of young white students up from Adelaide, all sharing in the sophisticated knowledge and enchantment that surrounds them. The children meander from one place where some old male elders sit by a smoky fire and teach them how to make spears, to the next where some old ladies sit cross-legged as they have done for generations and teach them how to weave. From here, they can go and get painted up for the dances that they will learn and perform later. They can learn how to make a wheelchair, which is an ancient yet enduring and traditional form of shelter. They can explore and wander up onto the ancient hills that hugs their camp, or they can just sit and yarn. Look at these children, Huey beckons with enthusiasm. Look at them, all happy and learning on my country. One minute, they're sitting here listening to us old people, and next minute, they're running all over these hills having fun. He pauses for a moment to bask in the euphoria of what is occurring all around him. This makes me so happy, he beams as tears of pride and joy mingle in his glinting, timeless eyes. Many might hear me proffer the term high expectations relationships and not really have a clue what I mean. Some might think of it as some nebulous, aspirational concept that is probably at best somewhere in the distant future, or at worst, merely a pipe dream, as our differences seem poles apart. The relationship between school and the community of Indalkana is manifestly a relationship with the first people of Australia based on respect and high expectations, where the two diverse worlds are brought together. This is no pipe dream. This is the stronger, smarter, high expectations relationship that I believe in. It's a relationship that offers tangible insights into how Australia can transcend the challenges we face together as Aboriginal and white Australians to become a truly great Australia with nothing to be ashamed of. As a basis for this discussion, let me start with the stronger, smarter philosophy, which has been articulated after much practice in schools and communities and reflection on what are the key overarching philosophical framework elements that do guarantee success. We describe the stronger, smarter philosophy in this way. We say the stronger, smarter philosophy honours a positive sense of cultural identity. It acknowledges and embraces positive community leadership, enabling innovative and dynamic approaches and processes that are anchored by high expectations relationships. And when we talk about higher expectations relationships, we say they are those which honour the humanity of others, and in so doing, acknowledge one's strengths, capacity, and human right to emancipatory opportunity. While some might dismiss my intent here as either too romantic or too ambitious, let me assert that the knowledge and skill required here is relatively basic. This is not to pretend for one moment, however, that the path forward is easy. In my conversations with school principals and teachers, time and time again, I've made it clear that we actually know what we need to know in order to transcend the challenges we face in Aboriginal education. The solutions are actually quite simple, yet the work is always and will always be very, very hard. We know money is not always the answer, and evidence abounds here. In some places it is true that money is required, while in other places resources are quite substantial. In every case, though, in every case, what is required before anything else is hard work, the kind of hard work that requires a high personal commitment and can sometimes come at a high personal cost. A part of what makes the work so hard is relinquishing those long-held, stifled beliefs and attitudes about Aboriginal students and Aboriginal people. And unless this is done, we cannot hope to engage in new and more honourable ways of thinking and behaving in the relationships with those Aboriginal children and their parents. And unless we create these new relationships, the failure will continue. It is almost as if many teachers and principals have to unlearn all that they believe about Aboriginal students, look past the black faces in the classroom, and start to see students. And when they start to see students as curious as any, they can then make honourable choices about what educational outcomes are good enough for these children. And then, having established educational outcomes that are more honourable and worthy of pursuit, and that would have intellectual integrity in any school, it then becomes worth remembering that we are in a relationship with Aboriginal children here. And at this point, we must observe and be receptive to any cultural complexities that might enhance or stifle our pursuit of those educational outcomes we established earlier. And again, while the stronger, smarter approach, a strength-based approach intent on doing things with people, not to them, might seem somewhat exotic and erudite, it is this very approach which underpinned the hard work and resulted in the good results that we achieved at Cherbourg School together, where unexplained absences were reduced by 94% within 18 months, where real attendance improved from 62% in 1999 to 94% in 2004, without touching anybody's welfare payments. Year 7 diagnostic reading tests went from 0% at state average, 0% of children at state average in 1998, to 81%, 58% improvement in Year 2 literacy within 2 years. And we saw 5 local Aboriginal teacher aides complete teacher aid training while they studied and continue to work at the school. Evidence shows this type of success has been replicated in numerous other schools and communities that have embraced the stronger, smarter approach. And it is my belief that this view can be extrapolated to reflect on and inform the broader societal relationship between Aboriginal and white Australia. It is worth restating to those interested in the pursuit of excellence for Aboriginal children and communities, the solutions are quite simple. Yet the work will always be hard. The first pillar of the Stronger, Smarter philosophy compels us to come to grips with our beliefs about what is truly a positive sense of cultural identity. And this cannot be done without first flushing out the dynamics of our relationships, and more specifically, those contained within the dominant conceptual binary of mainstream and other. Put simply, there is mainstream Australia and there is the rest, with dramatic undertones suggesting that it would be best if we just look, behave and speak like those in mainstream. The notion of othering is not new to intellectual discourse, and I've discussed this in greater detail in earlier works. But for the purposes of this discussion, it's useful to revisit some of that conversation given the intense and persisting subscription to the notion that the only way forward for Aboriginal Australia is to become mainstream, whereby that sense of being mainstream means surrendering being Aboriginal and further acquiescing to the notion that being Aboriginal means somehow being inferior. For the purposes of my PhD research, I conducted 30 forums involving more than 3,000 people, at which I asked participants to offer adjectives or words to articulate mainstream Australian perceptions of Aboriginal people. And I was always cautious to point out to them that I was not after their personal perceptions, but rather how they thought mainstream Australians would describe Aboriginal people. And there will be no surprise to you, and you can read about it in the paper later on, that it was a very negative, stereotypical view of who we are as Aboriginal people. Words like alcoholics, drunks, bungs, coons, niggers, all of those sorts of words welfare dependent, lazy, aggressive, violent, all of these kinds of words came up, none of which reflected the truth about who I was, none of which reflected the truth about my sense of being Aboriginal or the people who I grew up around. And it's always shocking to reflect on such research, and it's a reflection I don't particularly enjoy. And I'd like to imagine that if I conducted a similar research today, then I might get quite a different response, although I saw some article just recently that suggested that we still have a long way to go in terms of how we perceive Aboriginal people. I should say that on some occasions there were positive references to Aboriginal people being artistic or family-oriented or sporty, but for the purposes of this discussion I wanted to focus on those words that came up on every occasion. Now clearly it's not an accurate reflection upon who we truly are, and anyone who imagines it is some kind of accurate reflection should really question their own ability to connect with the humanity of others. And this isn't to deny that we have elements of these traits and behaviours in our communities, as all communities do, but it is to affirm that those descriptors are not part of Aboriginal cultural identity. These are stereotypes that have been cast upon us historically. Confronted with this phenomenon, it becomes imperative that we observe and understand the source of such toxic perceptions, given their ability to influence behaviour and somehow manifestly emerge as some form of reality for some. Now, as unpalatable as it might seem, there is no escaping, and I'm not apologising for this, there is no escaping that the greater source of such toxic perceptions is indeed white Australia. Now, this is not to lay blame for the current state of Aboriginal Australia entirely at the feet of white Australia, but it does take us to one of the central and most crucial points of this entire paper. Aboriginal Australia must not be dominated by this negative stereotype of who we are. We as Aboriginal people must be able to reject absolutely the negative stereotype of being Aboriginal that we have been consistently bombarded with. Only then can we understand, assert and define who we truly are based on our terms, defined also by the truth of our strengths, of our courage, of our dignity, of our connections to land, our humour in the face of despair, our broad sense of family and sense of spirituality, our ancient connections to this country that we share. And whilst false stereotypes exist, their dynamic presence has a dramatic effect. It typecasts an entire group of Australians to be feared or despised. In academic theory, they become the feared and despised or feared and despicable other. Such dishonourable posturing undermines not just the humanity of Aboriginal Australia, it ultimately undermines the humanity of all of us. And it is against this background that tolerating poor conditions becomes explainable. Put simply, if it is only hopeless and despicable Aborigines, then why should we bother trying to make a difference to their well-being or the functionality of their communities? If it is only hopeless and despicable Aborigines, then what is the big deal if a police officer is found to cause the death of one of them? If it is only Aboriginal communities, then why bother injecting quality teachers and health workers when we can eventually just blame the people in that community for such appalling dysfunction? The casting of Aboriginal Australians as a hopeless, feared or despised other has enabled some disobliging cycles of chronic neglect and draconian intervention. Intervention in terms of dispossession and alienation from land, neglect in terms of leaving people to die, intervention in terms of assimilation policies, neglect in terms of provision of adequate infrastructure and quality service provision. More recently, in this disobliging circle I speak of, casting Indigenous Australians as hopeless and despicable enabled the Northern Territory intervention, in which it was assumed that people were so hopeless and so despicable that we had to send in the army to fix them, and that we must somehow paradoxically empower them by quarantining their income. Time will tell whether or not we will indeed transcend beyond this despicable cycle together.
Aboriginal leader and educator Dr. Chris Sara, delivering the annual Griffith Review lecture. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online. I'm Paul Barclay. You can podcast or stream tonight's discussion and any other Big Ideas talks from our website at abc.net.au/RN, and you can follow us on Twitter at RN Big Ideas. Let's head back to the State Library of Queensland, where Chris Sara continues his talk, Beyond Victims, The Challenge of Leadership. He's talking about his personal understanding of identity and how his part Italian heritage resonates strongly when he visits the Italian village of his father's people, but how this doesn't detract from his Aboriginality or his Australianness.
You might be interested to know that neither the Australian flag nor the national anthem enhance my sense of being Australian. And while I accept that it may do for others, the Australian flag for me simply invokes thoughts of the shameful Cronulla riots and the offensive bumper stickers that say things like, "Fuck off, we're full." I suspect the Australian flag would enable my sense of being Australian to resonate more strongly for me and many others if it was free of the Union Jack. And if our national anthem was like that of New Zealand, Aotearoa, and embraced an Indigenous language verse, then I'd be much more proud to sing along and let my sense of being Australian hum. The prospect of changing the national flag or the national anthem is ambitious, I know, at best, but let me suggest this is a means by which we can contemplate ways to let our sense of being Australian resonate more strongly together, while accepting and embracing and celebrating the sense of otherness that indeed we all share. Understanding and embracing the notion of a stratified ontology not only liberates Aboriginal people from the toxic dynamics of being forced to be mainstreamed, it is indeed an intellectual concept that is emancipatory for white Australians. Many white Australians will have experienced this. Also, perhaps unknowingly, many of you will have experienced a very strong and a very powerful sense of something that you can't even describe, a sense of spirituality when you visit your graves of your ancestors in England or Scotland or Ireland, for instance. I know that you know what I'm talking about here. And at your core, in such circumstances, you remain human, while the differentia of your culture, your ancestral ethnicity, enhanced by the processuality of that time and that place, are the very dynamics that fill that hole inside them, as you are sometimes described. Importantly, you have not surrendered in that circumstance your sense of being Australian, but your sense of humanity is enhanced. The second pillar of the Stronger, Smarter philosophy signals the need to embrace Aboriginal leadership. And again, this is not so straightforward. In my own assessments of Aboriginal leadership over time, one can observe three categories of leadership: those who focus on being the victim, those who focus on booting the victim, and those who focus beyond victim status, or what I would call stronger, smarter leadership. Before I go on here, let me first challenge an unspoken convention amongst Aboriginal Australians. The convention I speak of here is one in which we are encouraged to refrain from practices of lateral violence and do not attack each other publicly. Now, I am deeply committed to upholding the essence of this convention, and as such, I'm not out to make any personal attacks here. I am, however, also deeply committed, even more deeply committed, to challenging ways of thinking and behaving that I consider unhelpful and contrary to the conduct of a high expectations relationship. It does not serve any of us to leave such ways of thinking and behaving unchallenged. On being the victim, some years ago it was my belief that when school leadership and community leadership walked in partnership, then positive results would emerge. My views had to evolve. It was not enough to simply walk in partnership. Nothing changed if leaders continued to collude with a sense of victim status. The dramatically low expectations which are killing our children remain in place while ever victim status is maintained. During a government review I conducted last decade, I recall a school that couldn't get Aboriginal students to turn up to school by 9 a.m. in the morning. The collaborative response from the school and community leadership was to make school starting time 10 o'clock, effectively lowering the bar of expectation. Now, some will argue that the manoeuvre of delaying the school starting time from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. is being culturally receptive to the needs of students, when it is clearly my argument that such a strategy is simply collusion with victim status, collusion with low expectations of Aboriginal children as a hopeless and pitiable form of other. Now, my evolved belief is that school must work in partnership with positive community leadership, and that this partnership must be anchored by high expectations relationships. Over the years, governments, for their part, have either affirmed or denied their role as victimiser, depending on the politics of the day, and in turn, Indigenous communities have affirmed or attempted to shed light on their victim status, depending on the counter-politics of the day. Some Aboriginal leaders have found success in encouraging victim status and embracing it, leading a cause that renders us powerless to act upon our own belief and therefore at the mercy of those in political power. They are encouraged to see themselves as victims, victims who should be compensated in some way or every way by victimisers for their historical grievances. Leading through victim status entails pushing for preferential treatment. Now, all leaders, Indigenous and not, will do this to some extent on behalf of their constituency. But in this model, Indigenous communities are likely to be seen as receivers of service rather than creators of emancipatory processes. Under this type of leadership, things continue to happen to Aboriginal people, not with them, since adhering strictly to victim status means that Aboriginal people are not responsible for their own lives. They become what Malcolm X called zombies, marching to the beat of someone else's orders. One is left wondering about the so-called benefits of such a toxic and dysfunctional relationship. And aside from the ability to lay blame and responsibility for change somewhere other than ourselves, it becomes clear that in such a relationship, white leadership, white Australian leadership, might actually enjoy and feel nice about the perception that they are being culturally receptive. And Aboriginal leadership might enjoy a misguided notion that they are reinforcing their sense of cultural identity, when in fact all they're reinforcing is a negative stereotype. Another so-called benefit might be that the circumstances where as an Aboriginal person, I can avoid being challenged intellectually about my behaviour simply by saying, you're just picking on me because I'm black, or you're being racist. Lots of white people I know would rapidly recoil at such a defence, as they are understandably precious about being called a racist. I know, as well as any Aboriginal person, that indeed sometimes we do get picked on just because we are black, and people are being racist, but not all of the time. In the interests of a healthy and high expectations relationship, Aboriginal leadership must purge this default defence mechanism and embrace questions and criticisms from white Australia. And I'm not suggesting for one moment that we do not call white Australia on their way of thinking or behaving if we genuinely smell that filthy stench of racism. But rather, we commit to making the time for embracing and dwelling on their feedback or the questions that you might have of me. Embracing your feedback, criticisms, or lines of question. Like many of you, I've watched in awe of the patience, wisdom, and humility of our old people as they display remarkable tolerance of white Australia. For white Australia, the challenge here is to show courage not to run away when we play that race card so readily. If your questions are in fact legitimate and in the interests of high expectations, then I invite you to call our bluff and hold us to account. Your lack of courage here serves no one, not even you. Whilst you might enjoy short-term gratification of avoiding conflict or a difficult conversation, Your prospect of developing a sustained level of respect is diminished. It is worth reiterating the point here that our prospects of engaging each other in the hard conversations that inevitably we must have are far better if we get the relationship right from the start. As I suggested to you earlier in this paper, if we get the relationship right by acknowledging and embracing the humanity we share and building our ability to challenge each other upon that. In relation to booting the victim-type leadership, there are those who've discovered that while being the victim is compelling at some levels, it is not always politically attractive. Therefore, another group of Aboriginal leaders have found political traction by booting the victims. Now, this type of leadership is deeply problematic for a range of reasons. At one level, it dismisses too easily the genuine complexity of the victim narrative, which on many occasions has validity, worth understanding. One can surmise that this form of leadership perhaps dismisses such complexity because it is either not completely understood, let alone experience any part of it. Now, it might display commitment and at sometimes a type of courage, but it lacks compassion and the ability to take people with them. It lacks the depth and humanity of the approach of modern history's most respected black leaders, like South Africa's Desmond Tutu and the late Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela. Mandela was jailed for saying things that needed to be said. Tutu has been vilified and lied about. But both men transcended the spin and venom of their opponents to change history and to change the world. They didn't court favour with political or corporate white masters. They didn't abandon genuine needs and hardships of their people and the complex truths creating them, because acknowledging these truths was inconvenient for their nation's white leadership. They didn't pretend that those central to the complexity of the dysfunction not to be challenged. The same can't be said in Australia, where some leaders are fearless in articulating the shortfalls of Aboriginal Australia. But they lack the courage and are being dishonest if they do not articulate the shortfalls of white Australia. If we are ever to move beyond blame or excuses and to make right the wrong, we must face the realities of Australia's ugly and complex Aboriginal history. What hope is there of white Australia overcoming her ignorance of this history if Aboriginal leaders continue to ignore it also? For two centuries, our people, without a voice, have had to endure, suffer, and try to recover from costly, clumsy, simplistic approaches to policy reform, many of which has booted the victim by making it seem like somehow it was their fault. Were Nietzsche here today, he would counsel us to distrust in all whom the impulse to punish is powerful. Let me further indulge by quoting from our greatest source of wisdom by saying, "It is better to be humble among the meek than to share the spoils of the haughty." The deeper problem here is that such views proffered by this kind of Aboriginal leadership validate the ignorance of political and corporate masters who actually have the power to make significant change. One of today's rewards for booting the victim-type leadership is the apparent circumstance in which one can proffer big-stick policy approaches that are so obviously expensive to taxpayers, yet so obviously ineffective, and not ever be seriously questioned. It seems as though conventional policy logic, with its empty rhetoric about evidence-based policy, is completely abandoned. There are circumstances in which the evidence says clearly that policy experiments concocted by booting the victim-type leaders are grossly expensive, dramatically ineffective. Yet these policy approaches or experiments are retained and rolled out to other communities that are powerless to defend themselves. Now, at the risk of casting as victims those communities that are subjected to such clumsy experimental policy approaches, it must surely be confusing to them. I can't help thinking it must be like those in George Orwell's Animal Farm, who watched the pigs take on the form of those they so despised at the start, encouraging them all at a time to shout, "Four legs good, two legs better." When some seem to recall a time when we shouted, "Four legs good, two legs bad." In the barnyard of the indigenous Australian policy landscape, I seem to recall a time in this revolution when we all shouted, "Culture good, assimilation bad." Well, today it seems that some leaders are encouraging us to believe and shout, "Culture bad, assimilation better." The final pillar of the Stronger, Smarter approach is about high expectations, relationships. It is worth restating the philosophical belief that high expectations honour the humanity of others and in so doing acknowledge one's strengths, capacity and human right to emancipatory opportunity. This is about doing things with people, not to people. This is about policy approaches designed to enable us as Aboriginal people to be the best that we can be, and not those that force us to comply with who you want to be. And before any of you start to wonder, our interest is in being exceptional, not in the current state that some of us are in. It's also crucial to note the dramatic difference between high expectations rhetoric and high expectations relationships. High expectations rhetoric is that zero tolerance approach that sees a child sent home when he does not have a full school uniform on. A high expectations relationship is where people at the school make time to find out whether or not his family can afford to buy uniforms and perhaps provide one in exchange for the parent coming up to do some one-on-one reading in the classroom. High expectations rhetoric will see a child suspended from school for swearing at the teacher. A high expectations relationship will try to understand all of the circumstances that caused them to swear in the first place. It may ultimately result in that child being suspended, but it could also result in the teacher apologising to the child for backing them into a corner and leaving them with no other option. It may also result in teaching the child that this way of speaking is not accepted in school. Within the confines of a high expectations relationship, any range of constructive solutions can be negotiated. Beyond schooling, and in a more general sense, high expectations relationships must be firm and they must be fair. There must be compassion and an understanding of the need for carrots, yet simultaneously within that same relationship, there must be courage to challenge and to execute sticks if they are required. Those who come to this relationship knowing only about compassion and fairness, without the courage to be firm, will only ever develop a low expectations relationship that colludes with mediocrity and victim status. Those who come to this relationship knowing only about wielding a big stick in such draconian ways, with no sense of compassion or understanding of the need for carrots, will only ever develop a low expectations relationship that colludes with low expectations perceptions of us as a hopeless and despicable other. In a high expectations relationship, you cannot bring me to the table and explain what you're going to do to me and call this consultation. In this relationship, we must be prepared to have robust intellectual dialogue, accepting that while we may not always agree or get our own way, we are deeply committed together to co-creating solutions to the often complex challenges we face together. In a high expectations relationship, we must have the courage to engage and challenge each other and not run from each other to avoid intellectually robust conversations that must be had. If I display inappropriate behaviours like verbally abusing you or threatening you or throwing tantrums to get my own way, then you must challenge me. And there must be consequences for such behaviours. Whether you are a senior bureaucrat, a senior politician, or some flash journalist, if there is a need to question the efficacy of the policy approaches I proffer, then you must have the courage to challenge me. I understand very well that many of you will feel discomfort at the prospect of challenging me or any other Aboriginal leaders. I also understand that for many of you, it may well be easier just to let me and those other leaders have their own way, have our own way, to avoid such conflict, to avoid such discomfort. Your lack of courage here serves no one. It does not serve you. It does not serve the people of the communities or the nation that we want to make greater. I'm compelled to remind you here that any discomfort that you would feel in such circumstance about the prospect of challenging me here as you should, any discomfort that you might feel pales completely into insignificance when compared to the discomfort of an Aboriginal teenager who holds a rope in their hand, wondering whether it is worth continuing to live in a community where all of his people are treated as though they are subhuman. In a high expectations relationship, we purge the toxic and restrictive binary of same, other, and its stifled belief that assimilation to mainstream is the answer. The notion of the concrete universal offers us some chance to recalibrate our relationship so that we are first connected by our humanity. When we are first connected by our humanity, then and only then do we have a chance of transcending the challenges we face together. Much of what I've had to say to you tonight is not new. I've found no reason to change what I say. I've not sought to reinvent myself or my message over the last few years, because all along I've been an advocate for an approach that has worked efficiently and effectively and has been replicated in many other schools and communities throughout Australia. Of course, I'm referring here to the Stronger, Smarter approach, and I'm not asking you to take a leap of faith here. I'm asking us to invest some interest in what we have come to know about the pursuit of excellence of Aboriginal people, not the pursuit of mediocrity, and not the pursuit of the past. My sense, though, is that there are many Australians too who may not like these big stick approaches that we're seeing at the moment and the pursuit of mediocrity, yet feel a genuine sense of exasperation, like somehow it is not nice, but this is the best that we can ever hope to do. I'm reminded here of a passage from a book by Martin Seligman called Learned Optimism, in which he referred to and described an experiment with two dogs performed some decades ago. Today, the ethics of such an experiment would be questioned, but it's an experiment that offers us some useful insights. One dog was contained in a box, and every time he put his head up, he received a mild and unpleasant shock. In another box, another dog putting his head up would also receive a mild and unpleasant shock, but on some occasions, he would receive a pleasant reward. The first dog developed a sense of learned despair, and as such, simply kept his head down entirely, feeling there was no reward ever for lifting his head up at any stage. The second, however, did not share a sense of despair, and despite the mild and unpleasant shocks now and then, it continued to raise its head, anticipating a pleasant reward from time to time. Now, it occurs to me that as I reflect on the relationship between Aboriginal and white Australia and the toxic historical cycles of neglect and intervention, that this is somewhat like the sense of learned despair that has emerged in Aboriginal communities over the years. Watching politicians and bureaucrats come and go, promising great change, yet delivering more failure and entrenching despair. It's an analogy that is easy to grasp and offers some insight into why some Aboriginal communities might seem so dysfunctional and so disengaged. But you know something? This analogy that I spoke of can also be used to illustrate that same sense of despair that may have become learned and entrenched within white Australia as it searches for a genuine way forward in Aboriginal policy reform. Now, I recognise that on the question of Aboriginal policy reform, white Australia's sense of despair might be just as entrenched as Aboriginal Australia's sense. And in recognition of this, I offer this tonight. There is a different way that enables us to have a more honourable relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australia. And if you don't believe me, just ask Hughie and Paula Maguire at Indalkina. And whilst today we might observe some small-minded and stifled approaches to policy reform or policy regurgitation, this is not the time to get blinded by frustration or anger and to not let that sense of despair become further entrenched. In times such as this, I'm reminded of a very great and very honourable Australian, Vincent Lingiari. He never lost faith in what was right and what was good. As Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody note in that great ballad from Little Things, Big Things Grow, Vincent told his people, "Let the stars keep on turning." He also said, "We know how to wait." In the face of frustration and injustice, Vincent Lingiari never lost faith in what was right and what was good. You see, the truth is the truth. And as long as we hold firm and steadfast to what we know is the truth, then ultimately we can be fine. Other approaches, regardless of how much smoke and mirrors exist around them, will come and go. The smoke will eventually disappear, and people will want to come back to what they believe is the truth. And that is where we will be, because we never left it in the first place. Together, let's subscribe to notions of optimism about this honourable relationship that can exist, rather than notions of hopelessness and despair. May our hearts beat closely together, with our relationship calibrated properly from the very start and for the pursuit of excellence. When we let our hearts beat close together, it is then and only then that we all become more in tune with the rhythm of this great land that we share. When we are first connected by our humanity, when our hearts beat closely together and in tune with the rhythm of the land we share, when we share an interest in the pursuit of our collective excellence, then and only then do we have a chance of transcending the challenges we face together. Thank you.
That was Dr. Chris Sara delivering the 2014 Griffith Review Lecture at the State Library of Queensland. Chris Sara is an Aboriginal leader and educator and the founder and chairman of the Stronger, Smarter Institute.
On Background Briefing, the Cairns Mega Casino Gamble.
It's a very, very big project built on an artificial island about a kilometre long. It's a game changer.
The developers say it'll target and depend on overseas gamblers. So why do they want 1,500 poker machines?
That's targeted, in my mind, solely at the local market.
This is going to be overseas people, and it's not going to touch the locals. It has been proved wrong every time.
You can download this Background Briefing from the RN website.